Welcome to Drop Everything, podcast number 135. I'm your host, Dan Holzman. On this episode, our special guest is performer Leah Orleans. Before we talk to Leah, though, let's thank our sponsor, the IJA. That stands for International Jugglers Association. Want information about jugglers, the festival, anything about juggling at all? Go to juggle.org and find out about this great group of jugglers called the IJA. Okay, now Leah is a great performer, also a producer of a wonderful magic festival coming up March 10th through the 12th. It's called the Mystify Magic Festival. You can find out information at mystifymagicfestival.com. All right, drop everything. Get ready for Leah Orleans. Welcome to Drop Everything podcast number 135. A big welcome to my very, very special guest, Leah Orleans. Hello, Leah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very excited. You have a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things that are different about you and your act than other performers we've had on. First off, you come from a family of entertainers, which is very unusual. Where were you born and what does your father and other parts of your family do? I mean, I don't know if your mother is in the entertainment business as well, but
yeah,
what do they do for a living?
Yeah, so I was born in Chicago, and my dad is Danny Orleans, and my mother is the incredible Jan Rose, and they are both magicians and entertainers. My mom is currently the resident host at the Chicago Magic Lounge. She's the MC there. If you go there and see a small woman with big hair, that is her, and I look pretty much exactly like that, but just a little younger, and they raised me in a very entertainment-forward, arts-forward household. So we grew up there together, and my dad was traveling all the time, and my mom was driving me around to circus and acting classes, and it really gave me a good foundation.
So from a very young age, did you always want to be a performer? Did you ever rebel and say, I want to be an accountant?
No, I had the bug super early on. I loved being on stage. And I think I was also surrounded by people who made a living doing what they loved. And that was really ingrained in me. And my parents were always very supportive of any direction that I took as long as I worked hard at it. And that led me to find an education that was also really arts forward and entertainment forward. And they were totally cool with me not going to a normal college as long as I kept learning and kept going to a school or education programs or training programs that helped me learn more about what I wanted to do.
So would you say they didn't push you, but they definitely encouraged you to go into the business?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. I think if I woke up one day and said, no, I want to be, you know, a veterinarian or something different, they would have totally supported that. I don't think they would have known where to start in terms of helping me, where they definitely had the ins and the connections to assist in helping me find coaches and mentors. But yeah, they're pretty unconditionally supportive.
So when a parent travels a lot for gigs, was that difficult? Were there long periods of time where he'd be on the road? Or what was his schedule like as you were growing up?
Yeah, my dad works a lot of trade shows. So he's gone for 3 to 5 days at a time usually. And it definitely affected me. And I kind of learned a lot about that. And I remember as a young kid, being kind of confused and being like, wait, like, so he loves what he does. All my friends' parents have jobs where they hate what they do. But he loves what he does, so it's like fun for him, but he's choosing that over spending time with us. And I had to kind of grapple with that a little bit, but I quickly understood and learned that, you know, when you're home, you plant the seeds, and when you go away to do the gigs, that's when you can harvest the fruit. And that really helped me kind of put things in perspective. And I now travel 10 months out of the year myself. So I think, you know, that apple didn't fall too far from the tree to continue with my fruit analogy.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
No, it's just me.
Oh, and so do you feel that the quality time, like it was important for when he was there, that the time was quality? So you understood that when he was gone, he had work to do, but that when he was home, you definitely were the focus and he was able to spend time with you that was meaningful.
Very much so. Both my parents were that way. They were very supportive. And because if he wasn't on the road, he was working from home. So he would drive me to school and pick me up and come see my shows and help me with homework and things like that. So I definitely got a ton of parent time. And as I got older, sometimes I'd go too. We'd go to a convention together or get to travel together. And that was always really fun.
And what kind of lessons did you learn from him sort of growing up in the business? Did you see him doing particular things that you then use in your business as well?
Absolutely. I think marketing is such a huge element of that. He's a trade show magician. And if you don't know what that is, it's instead of your typical magician that's doing a show representing himself, my dad often looks like another employee of the company that he's representing and being hired by. So he's in a polo shirt with their logo on it and helping attract other potential clients to their trade show booth through entertainment and magic and fun messaging, marketing materials. And so I used to watch him work through these briefs for, ExxonMobil and HP and these ridiculously corporate-y companies with all this corporate jargon. And he would turn those marketing words into a script that then he would memorize and turn into magic tricks. And I got to watch him do this over and over and over again. And I think that really taught me how, at the end of the day, entertainment is all marketing. Whether you're marketing yourself or you're marketing and representing another company, you're getting someone else to understand a brand. And that brand could be your own identity or it could be the company you're working for. But supporting that brand really is the vehicle, that your magic can ride on or your entertainment can ride on. And I carry that through everything I do now, too.
And one of the difficulties of trade shows is there's a lot of information they want you to impart about the particular products. And you're always, we always were thinking, and me and Barry did it, that we wanted to be more entertainment focused, and the companies always wanted to be more information focused. So the ability to incorporate that in an entertaining way is a real balancing act.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's really, really good at putting his entertainment ego down and getting that information out. And I think that's part of why he's so successful in this world too. And he genuinely likes it. I think he really likes it, and it brings him joy. He's a very left brain artist. He's very spreadsheets and numbers kind of guy. So I think it fits well for him.
I think that's a good thing for other people to learn is the fact that it fits well. Like, to be a trade show presenter, it's good to have a certain image, a certain amount of sophistication, a certain amount of sort of ability to represent in a positive way. And not every performer can pull that off.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about your upbringing a little bit, and as far as your education goes, what were like some of the first classes you took? And did you feel that magic, since your dad was a magician, was the way to go? How'd you become so versatile in your performing skills?
Yeah, that's a great question. I started at Looking Glass Theater Company. It was the first classes that I took in Chicago. It's a theater company in Chicago that had youth classes and after school programs, and I loved it. And I loved their approach. It was very physical theater, super kind of jumping around, kind of get the character in your body sort of work. And I took classes with them all through middle school, high school. I became part of their teen ensemble, their young ensemble. I performed with their adult ensemble a few times and did some professional work with them. And then I did professional theater as a kid. I did film and acting and theater and commercials and things as well. So I hurtled into the professional world pretty quickly, and that got me surrounded by people who really took me seriously, and I think that's what I enjoyed the most. And then I ended up going to the World Magic Seminar Teen Weekends. Lance Burton used to sponsor these teen weekends at the World Magic Seminar Magic Convention in Las Vegas, and I attended a ton of those where it was taught by Jeff McBride and Eugene Berger and Dr. Larry Haas and a few other notable minds in magic. And once again, we were all treated like adults. It was a group of teenagers, but the memories I have from there are them really taking us seriously and treating us and teaching us and coaching us like adults. And if you look back on those years, on that generation that I was part of, so many of those kids that I grew up with are working magicians today. So many of them. And they're my good friends now. And they're all professional, working, full-time magicians. Girls, boys, women, men, all of us. It's really cool to see how kind of effective that program was. And when I look back at my early education, theatrically and circus-wise and magic-wise, my most useful teachers were people that treated us like adults and talked to us with the sternness required to do so. And I thought that was really cool.
Well, that's one big difference between sort of the juggling field and the magic field, is there's definitely more mentors, there's more instruction, and you're able to sort of come up. I know there's a teen program at the Magic Castle that a lot of performers went through. We really don't have that same thing in the juggling world,
Yeah.
which is unfortunate.
It's interesting. I'm not truly sure. I have in with the juggling world and I'm involved with the IJA, but I was not a young juggler per se. I didn't really learn to juggle until much later in my 20s, but it It's interesting, and it's interesting with YouTube and the internet too, how that's really shifting. Because I was right on the edge of that. I'm 30 now, and like I didn't have a smartphone until my last years of high school, and that might seem young, but for me now, looking at Gen Z and these kids growing up with the entire internet at their fingertips and community is pretty crazy to see.
Well, now you seem to be doing quite well as a digital creator. Is that something that's kind of a big part of your career now, the fact that you
It is very much so.
have an online presence?
Yeah, it is. And I think that ties back into marketing and how that's such a huge love of mine in entertainment marketing. And as I got into my own career and formed a show that was marketable individually, I really took it on myself to go deep with the digitals of it all and find a deep social media presence, then grow that and nurture that. And it took decades, as it does. And it's a whole lot of work. And I have a team of people that get to do things that I do not have time to do. And I think that really helps. But I really do love it.
And do you find that coming up, like in the booking process? Do people ever ask, like, how many followers do you have?
Yeah.
Is that something that helps you get more work, you think?
Absolutely, it does. I think when I tipped over 100,000 followers was on Instagram was really when it started. Usually people aren't asking me how many followers I have. Usually it's the other way around. They're finding me through Instagram first. So I'll get a call and say, "Hey, we saw your video on Instagram. Are you available for this gig?" And that happens kind of a lot. And it's really cool to be an in now. And instead of doing a mailing, I'm just making a few videos a week, which is a lot more effort, arguably, but it is a form of advertising. And whenever a video of mine happens to go super viral or spikes a few million views, I brace myself for an inbox influx of people wanting me to come to their event. And I would say, 60% of those inquiries, 70% of those inquiries are events that absolutely do not make sense for what I do, and people that just want me to come to their birthday party or
Right.
think that I'm funny and wonder if I do something that does not fit. And I always get to respond very nicely, but sometimes those gigs work, and when they do, it's great.
Well, that's important for other performers to hear that it is sort of a part of modern marketing and modern performing. And is it something also that provides an income source?
Kind of. Not directly as much. I'm still making more money from actual shows and gigs that I do. I'm not at the creator standpoint where I'm making a living off of making videos. I think that kind of happens around the 1 million mark or 75,000 kind of follower mark. I do not monetize at that ability. I get a little check from TikTok every month, but it's maybe a few $100. And then additionally, I'll do a brand spark partnership or sponsorship and get some money for making a series of videos, but it's not the big bucks. I'm not pushing it super hard yet.
Well, that's good to know. I just being realistic.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot of people think like, oh, if I get a Facebook or a YouTube or Instagram, automatically the money will just start flowing in.
No, that is not how it works. And I know that some platforms are more profitable than others. I've heard a lot about how YouTube is a stronger monetization platform, but you need to be making videos that are longer than like a minute, like longer form content that is people are sitting and watching for a long time. And that's not really what I have interest in doing right now and what I have the time and resources to do on my back end. If I think if it was like a pandemic situation and I wasn't touring at all and I was just home, I could go into that, but that's not. I like doing short form content a little more right now.
Well, it's a whole different animal, I think. And of course, I think you have to be sometimes in a certain niche that's more, I don't know what they call it particularly, that's more popular. Like just being an entertainer or doing, juggling or magic, I don't think is as big as if you're a travel promoter or you're talking about politics. I think there's certain things that have more of an audience just to begin with.
Sure, yeah. I know a few entertainers and content creators that have pivoted to full-time socials and they're doing quite well, but I think also that's what they're doing full-time. They're spending, 6 days a week making videos and editing videos and posting videos and growing their following and talking to brands and they're not as much of an entertainer on top of that. They are a creator. And they are an entertainer. They have their comedy chops and their circus skill chops, but Like Josh Horton is a great example of that. Like he really monetized this. Grace Good is another friend of mine. Jaxie Whipper is a well-known whip artist and friend too. And he's really pulled into that super heavy. But that is really the full focus.
Now, when you look at a performer like Jaxie Whipper, I've only seen him on the internet. It seems like yourself, that he has a certain acting background. Do you think that your acting background has allowed you to present a show that's different than when you see someone who doesn't come from that background?
100%. Yeah, he was raised in the circus as well. And then he worked for a very long time at WBUR and NPR being a host. So he has an incredible ability to understand the pulse of trends and media in general. He's really, really, really smart, really educated historically and technically. And his wife is a professional video producer and creator. So together they're an amazing team. And we've been good friends for like a decade. And it's been cool to watch him grow. You know, he deserves all of the success in the world. He works his butt off. And I feel similarly with what I do of a lot of the work that I do is character-based theater. So I'm not really the sort of circus act that would go into like a Cirque du Soleil or do a 5-minute cabaret routine in like a GOP or something. I like to talk. I'm a talking act. Talking is almost more important to me than any skill that I do. So I often get hired as a host or an MC with additional skills or being able to talk off the cuff or stall for time or produce an award or present some sort of talent show. Like these are the things that I love doing and I think I have a specialty in. And specifically, people hate public speaking. You know this, you know, having the ability to talk on a microphone comfortably is such a incredible, unique resource and trait. So I try to lean into that as much as I can.
I see that sort of jugglers fall into two camps, and most of them, they start as jugglers. Maybe they come from athletics or just sort of like a particular childhood where they were kind of drawn to these kind of circus activities. They develop a lot of skill. Then they have to figure out, well, how do I present this?
Yeah.
And a lot of them really don't have any theater background. And I think they tend to become more of like sort of the shouty jugglers. Like it's just like them screaming louder. And they tend to also rely on more stock material because They didn't really come up.
Because writing is hard.
Yeah, the writing and the humor is difficult. And if that's sort of something you're coming to very late in your development as a performer, I think it's hard to catch up to performers who grew up in a theatrical environment. Let's talk about some of your first paid engagements. So how did you start your professional career?
It's hard to know where exactly that starts. So I started doing film and theater as a kid in Chicago, and then that pivoted. I started getting paid for circus a little more so as a teenager, doing contortion gigs and work. And then I went to circus school, and then I met up with Etienne McKinley, and we formed Acrobatrics, which was a two-person comedy circus show. And we toured Renaissance festivals and cruise ships and colleges for 9 years together. And we created this kind of Abbott and Costello, fast-talking, big-shotty, kind of fun circus show. And it was really, really successful, and we had a lot of fun doing it. And that was able to also be successful because of his previous work in Renaissance fairs and cruise ships, and he had all these connections. So he was able to pitch our new show to people that knew him and trusted him, and we kind of took off pretty quickly together.
Well, let's start by talking about Renaissance fairs.
Yeah.
For the performers who've never worked in that environment, give us a little bit of an insight into what kind of shows do you do, how many shows you do a day, it's just weekends, and what's it like to sort of work outdoors in that environment?
Yes. So for people that don't know what they are, I often describe them as a mixture between a themed amusement park and a farmer's market and a music festival, somewhere in the middle of that. And they're family-friendly events that happen on only Saturdays and Sundays. There's about 35 of them across the country. They range in size. Some of them have a few hundred people per day. Some of them have up to 40,000 people per day. They can get very large and very elaborate. And they're themed medieval and Renaissance energy, but it's kind of a loose theme, especially as we've gotten into the current social and pop culture climate, where they're really embracing fantasy. They're embracing cosplay. And for people to come and dress up, our guests can dress up or patrons can dress up and run around all day. And instead of like a music festival that would have bands and shows, they have theater spaces with variety acts. And we do usually between a 30-minute and a 45-minute long set. I do 4 shows a day on average. So 4 shows Saturday, 4 shows Sunday, and sleep on Monday. And they're open from morning until sunset usually. Yeah, I'm spending about 6 to 8 months out of the year doing Ren Fairs. My 2025 Ren Fair tour is going to be April through October. So it's a huge part of my job. And I love them because I have creative control, which is really one of my most important needs when it comes to booking myself. I really love the ability to write my own show, go off the cuff if I want, you know, of course, within reason. I can't get up there and start doing inappropriate things, but when I keep it family friendly, I can kind of do whatever I want. And it's really great. It's really, really satisfying to have that type of gig.
And at this point in time, do all the performers get to use amplification? Do they have microphones?
Yes, that is a thing. Back a long time ago, that was not a thing. I know you're referring to the time when Ren Fairs were a lot stricter. No amplification and no unicycles and all these rules. Yeah, that's shifted a lot. I need amplification because I have audiences of 500 people. A headliner act, I'm on these big stages, and there's no way that I could reach the back of my audience with just my voice. So yes, we have amplification. Not every stage at every festival does, but the ones that I do is a necessity for me.
Yeah, there's quite a large stages at some of these festivals. What's your circuit look like? Which Renaissance fairs do you do?
So for my 2025 tour, I'm going to do 7 weeks at the Los Angeles Renaissance Fair, known as the Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale, California, about 45 minutes outside of Los Angeles. And then I'll be doing 4 weeks at the Oregon Renaissance Festival, 2 weeks at the Bristol Renaissance Festival, 2 weeks at the Washington Renaissance Festival, and then back to Bristol for another 2 weeks. It's kind of an odd back and forth, but that's what had to happen. And then I'll close that out with 8 weeks at the New York Renaissance Festival, which is my favorite fair of them all.
And what juggling acts do you run into on the circuit?
Oh, lots of friends.
Any particular come to mind?
Yeah, we have lots of friends. And that's another great part of this gig is that there's friends. I have this community of incredible, talented acts all over the place. I don't know if you know Hilby. He's a juggler. Mm-hmm. He's so funny and so good.
Yep, the skinny German juggling boy. Yeah.
Skinny German juggling boy. Yeah. Aaron Bonk, Fire Whips and Swords, is a very close friend of mine and my partner. And he works Renaissance festivals with me as well, doing his own act, the Aaron Bonk Fire Whip and Sword Show. But we get booked together often, which is lovely. And then I'm friends with John Norton, the Flaming Ginger. He's really funny. He's a great juggler and incredible ladder walker and unicyclist. And he's so quick. His humor is so fast and funny. Paolo Garbanzo is a really good friend of mine who does Ren Fairs as well. He's hilarious. He frequents IJAs sometimes as well. It's a great community. We have a lot of fun together.
And how important is it to have sort of a character name? It seems like, the acts that sort of are do well, like you have a particular character name you use at the Renaissance fairs. Very few people say, like, I'm Dan Holzman. It seems like it's better to have kind of a character that people can relate to, like the Kamikaze Fireflies.
Some of them have, Aaron Bonk goes by his own name, which is already fun and silly. And that just happens to be his real name.
Is that his real name, Aaron Bonk?
It is. That is his real name. Yes. He went through middle school with that name. That's his joke.
Well, that's why you took up whips, right? Just to have that
ability
to protect himself.
Yep. I think part of the joy of Renaissance fairs is that you can go a little harder in the paint with the character and you can dive a little deeper. I go by Star Power, and star is spelled S-T-A-H-R, which is like this funny, you just add another letter in there to kind of, give it a little bit more of a tilt. And Star she's close to Leah. She's a little more evil, a little more mischievous. And she kind of has a little bit more of a tone in her voice that can kind of go in different places. And it's fun to have that space. Like, the audience gives you that space to play. And I find when I do theaters or cruise ships or other types of events, I can't play that hard because it's weird. People they don't believe you. Like, it feels odd. But Ren Fairs allow me to stretch that character limit a little more and play into the theater. I don't think it's necessarily 100% essential to have a strong character at Renaissance fairs, but I do see more successful acts having some sort of vibe.
Well, I think it's important with the costuming and the affectation to sort of play the role.
Yeah, you gotta have a strong costume for sure. Yeah, that's really important at run fairs. You can't just show up looking kind of dull. It's important that you stand out because your audience is also in costume. Is such an interesting element of it. They're encouraged to come dress up. They can buy costumes. They can rent costumes. So you gotta look at least a few steps above, however they are.
Yeah, we gotta throw in the lords and ladies, gather round.
A dear sweet audience. I'm using my dear sweet audience a lot more too because it's actually gender neutral and a lot of festivals are really liking that because we're really attracting a big queer population is coming to run fairs, which is great and fun and welcoming and wonderful, and we're kind of moving towards that direction.
Do you find that sort of a common theme in modern entertainment, like on the ships? They're trying to be more inclusive. Do they want you not to say, ladies and gentlemen? Is that something that's sort of unspoken? Or do people actually talk to you about trying to be more inclusive to the general public that way?
I think I personally try to be. That's where my heart is. It's where my brand is. It's where my people are. It's where I am. You know, I'm queer, and I have so many friends in that space. And I always really try to go the extra mile to make sure that everybody knows that they're welcome here, and to not even feel that little tiny cringe, especially in the beginning of my show. You know, one of the first things I say, and I want that to be immediately happy and welcome, and those people will be fans of yours for life, you know, and it really underlines that. I think there are certain places where I can let that flag fly a little brighter, Renaissance fairs being one of those places. Sometimes when I do corporate gigs or other things, I have to be a little bit more like zipped up, but that doesn't mean I'm you know, I think one of the cool things about saying my dear sweet audience is that it is gender neutral, it is inclusive, but it's not like, hey, you gays, let's be gay, right? Like it's calm. It's not ridiculous. And but it allows everybody to immediately feel welcome without any sort of flags being put up. So I really love saying that regularly.
Now, you go by sort of Tiny Girl Big Show as the name of your act. So is that something that you think has it played a part in sort of your career? Like being a female, we have very few female guests. There's very few female jugglers, unfortunately, who seem to be working. And you seem to be one of the few kind of solo female performers, especially in that circuit. Is that a real plus, or do you think that sometimes people don't take you as seriously and maybe they prefer to hire male acts? Is that something you run into?
You know, it's funny. When I was making the choice to go from a duo act to a solo act, I think I was terrified that I wouldn't be taken seriously. I felt like I had a really, really big hill to climb. I was really down on feeling afraid that, you know, I didn't have a man negotiating for me and it wouldn't work as well as I think it would. But it actually ended up being absolutely incredible. And so many more bookers and so many more people told me how excited they were that they were going to be able to offer their audience a strong, funny, talented solo female act and how ready they were for that. And also, I think if people aren't going to take me seriously, maybe I don't want to work with them. Like, there's enough gigs out there to work the ones you want. There really is. And especially if you know how to market yourself properly to those places, it's capable. You know, you're capable no matter what gender you are.
And what do you think about like safety concerns? Do you feel like sometimes you're at the mercy of unwanted attention because, being a performer, being a woman out there alone, do you sometimes feel that it's a not a dangerous situation, but how do you go about sort of protecting yourself?
That's a very real reality. You know, I don't have like an easy answer. I keep a knife in my car. I don't know. I do travel alone a lot. I'm driving across the country alone a lot. When I'm going in and out of places that I don't know and I'm alone, I don't look cute. I'm wearing an oversized hoodie and no makeup, right? Like I have my basement troll costume, essentially, right? Like I actively try not to attract attention, to look vulnerable, to look like a target, You know, and I hate even having to say that, but it's true. It's the world we live in, where if I ran around middle of nowhere Ohio gas stations at midnight in short shorts and a crop top, I'd have a very different sort of interaction with the guy at the gas station. So I think a lot of it is just kind of appearance and energy. I do what I can to stay with friends or to have people around me or to check up with people. I have a whole network of people that are like, text me when you get in, you know, that sort of thing. And also just like paying attention, like just being aware of your surroundings, you know, not having your headphones in, not looking down at your phone, like being alert and being around helps a lot. And yeah, and doing what I can to kind of keep that guard up.
And it must have helped sort of starting in a duo, because at least you sort of had the experience of being in these situations. You didn't like it just thrown into it on your
Yeah,
own. You sort of had a start with a partner. Now, what do you
definitely.
think is, do you think it's important to have a partner? Does it give you a different sense of being on stage so that when you go solo, what are some of the advantages of having a partner, and what are some of the advantages of being a solo?
Yeah, no, that's a great topic. And it's worth mentioning too that not all of my shows, but a good chunk of my shows, I have a musician with me, a live musician, an assistant that works with me. And there's two different people that I work with, Chloe and Morgan, and I switch between them based on their availability and what works for our schedules, and they both can do the role. And then also, I've had other people kind of step in on that role too. My friend Andrew or Aaron has actually done it for me. And that's my happiest place too, actually working with kind of like the sidekick. But I'll get to that in a second. I worked in a partnership in a very 50-50 shared expectation, shared workload, shared profit partnership for almost a decade. And we worked very well together. And Etienne McKinley, if you know him at all, he's an incredibly hard worker, very, very detail-oriented, and very good at analyzing the amount of work that has to be done and making sure that we have enough time to do that. And we worked very well together in that way. We both have a very similar drive. And it allowed us to make some big steps for our career. And it was also fun because the things that he was good at, he could do, and the things that I was good at, I could do. I did all the social media and a lot of the video work and our costuming and our banners and the art end of it. He did a lot of the tech stuff. He handled all the sound equipment and the packing, and he's also an incredible cook and a bunch of other things. And we were able to kind of share that workload. And I think that's great to be able to share that workload with someone. But also, what comes on that is there's ev everything has to be a vote at the end of the day, too. You know, you both have to have this, you have to be on the same page the whole time with how a joke is going to be said or what this type of trick is going to do or when we do this and when we do that and what scene happens when. And, you know, you have to be in agreement at least most of the time, if not all of the time. And that can be hard. And I think we were very aligned for a while. But when I started working solo, I really learned, I was like, oh, I can just have this idea and do it. Like, I don't have to check with anybody. And that also is kind of this odd thing of like, no one's telling me yes. Like, no, you don't need to get approval, but also you don't get approval. So I had a lot of kind of creative freedom. I was like, oh, I could just like come up with this crazy idea and just execute it and try it the next day, and I don't have to talk to anybody about it. And that was cool to feel. And I didn't really feel that. I've never really felt that before. I really went solo. I had a career before I worked with Etienne, but it wasn't as involving of a self creation. I was working on other people's shows or in a commercial or in something that I was being directed by. So it was really powerful to have 100% creative freedom. And then having a musician and having an assistant, Morgan helped me write the role. Her name is Morgan Howard. She's out of New York. She's an incredible musician and singer and a musical theater background and artist. And she's super smart and really, really hard worker as well. But I brought her on and I was like, okay, I'm hiring you. I'm paying you. You know, this is my IP, but I need you to help me write this role because I don't know music. I have a vision for what I want it to be, but I'm tone deaf, dude. I can't sing for shit. And I need your help. So we worked together in this partnership, and the creation really felt like a partnership. And whenever I'm on stage with her, it feels like a partnership. But I know at the end of the day, it is It is my show and it's my responsibility. And it's my responsibility to negotiate contracts and to make sure that we have a hotel and we have a rental car and we're housed and we whatever, you know, that's not on her at all. Her job is to show up and be in a good mental headspace to do a long day of shows and to be able to execute her role and take care of me if I need assistance, which she does an incredible job at doing, and we're great friends, you know, and I really love working with her. So it's a different energy, though. It's a different partnership, and there's more responsibility on me for sure, but I also get to maintain ownership, and that's nice.
Well, I think a good lesson to learn is that when you're working with a partnership, there should be 50%, you know, 50-50 effort. But the idea is you don't split it based on, okay, you do 50% of the marketing, I'll do 50% of the marketing.
Right.
You do 50% of the technical stuff, I'll do 50% of the technical stuff. If you can play more to your strengths and each contribute in a way that makes sense, as long as you're both kind of contributing equally, but you shouldn't be expected, like, I write half the jokes, you write half the jokes. You got to play on your strengths.
Yes, 100%. I think a good kind of barometer is to find somebody that likes to work the same amount that you do and is the same amount of self-motivated as you do. And that doesn't mean you both need to be workaholics, but if you're in a partnership where you find that one person is doing much more effort than you are, if that can feel very unfair very quickly. You know, I felt lucky that Etienne and I both were like nose to the grindstone type of people. And I've seen partnerships too where both people are kind of like, they're more lax and they're more chill and they both love just kind of messing around until they come up with something. And that works really well for them. I don't know if you know Tom and Benjamin.
Oh, of course. I know them as, I don't know them as Tom and Benjamin. I know they have a show together, like a dinner and a show.
God, they're so funny, man.
He's the last podcast guest I had. He'll be out the month before you. We did because he's also chairman of the board now, or actually chairperson of the board. Of the IGA.
Yeah,
I love him. So we talked a lot about the future of the organization and his role in that.
Ugh, I love them so much, and I'm such huge fans of their work, and watching their partnership is really, really fun for me. Big, big, big fans. And they're a great example, too, of people that have their own careers separately and a strength together. They're not only working together or only working separate. They've really been able to make it work for so long with being able to maintain both of those things, and I think that's beautiful.
Well, I think work is a good word. I think one thing people think is when they get into this business, whether it's Renaissance fairs or, you know, wanting to be a juggler, that, oh, I want to do this because it's not going to be hard work, or I don't want to work very hard. So I think one thing you can do as a performer is you can outwork people, because a lot of people are slackers in this business. So if you have a good work ethic, and you go, okay, maybe I'm not able to out technical them or out, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But I certainly can outwork people.
Oh, God. I mean, my juggling routine is two double tosses, like two double flips. Like I'm juggling three clubs. I cannot juggle more than three items, okay? I'm juggling three clubs. I do two double tosses, and then I intentionally drop. I do a few under-the-leg throws with knives. I juggle fire, just juggling three fire torches. Do like maybe a few under the leg tosses and some chops if I'm feeling ballsy, and slide down into a split. That is my entire juggling routine. I am not a talented juggler, but I'm funny. And the show is strong for a whole bunch of other reasons. And I also don't bill myself as a juggler, that being said, as well. I never, ever say that I am, it is a juggling show, because it is not. But yeah, the character is significantly stronger than my technical ability. I will tell you that right now.
And what do you think people's expectations are for jugglers? I don't think people know a lot about juggling.
No, they don't.
So I think that it's more important. So where do you consider the entertainment value as opposed to the technical value?
Absolutely. My jokes are so strong in that routine. That routine works as a stand-up routine without juggling. I know because I've done it. It's how I wrote it at open mics. The jokes are strong enough to live on their own, and then I just get to add some flippy bits, and it's eye candy for them. Now, you know, I think every entertainer is different. Every juggler is different. If you're looking at, you know, somebody like Wes Peden or Jay, you know, you're going to get a very different, you're watching something different. You're having a different experience. With me, you are relating to me socially. You're relating to my humor. I'm making relationship jokes and jokes about my heritage and where I come from and things that are, it's relatable. You know, it's exposition for me. That routine is exposition. You get to know about who I am, what I like, what scares me, weird elements of history. You know, I make a joke about my first juggling torches I made when I was 12 years old out of barbecue sticks and my sister's hamsters. And it's a joke of me burning my sister's pets. Like, and I say that while I'm balancing a fire torch on my nose. So they get this visual. They see the element. They see the barbecue stick. And then the punchline is sister's hamsters. And they look up and they see this burning thing that looks kind of like in the shape of a hamster. And that's the joke. Like, that's the bit. The entertainment comes from the relation, not from the skill for me.
Well, I think it's important to know what you're selling.
Yeah.
There's some jugglers who, they're basically selling great technical skill. Like, yeah. Anthony Gatto is a perfect example of it's watch me do these incredibly difficult things in a stylish way, of course. But not everybody is selling the same things. Like, the Karamazovs sold it more as a theatrical experience.
Yeah.
And I see you selling yourself more as a variety show based on your personality. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the elements of your show. One big element seems to be whips. That also seems to be a big part of Aaron Bonk's show. Mm-hmm. What is it about whips, especially in the Renaissance Fair, that makes them so popular?
They make a lot of noise, and I think that's good. I like doing whips in my intro. It makes a lot of noise in the beginning of the show. It helps draw a crowd and let everybody know that something big is starting. It's different. You don't see it a lot. There's Aaron, me, Jack, and Adam Crack that really use whips heavily. And then there's a few other acts that use them in one or two elements of their show. My style with whips is also very acrobatic. I use them similarly to like rhythmic gymnasts where you're like dancing around and flipping and throwing and catching them with cracks. So I really try to make it my own in that way and give it its own kind of visual eye candy, ear candy combo. Yeah, I really like it. I like the way that it feels and looks with my character.
It's also one of the shows you're a part of is something called the Whippy Show. Is that the four whip crackers you mentioned all together in one show?
Yes, it is. So that is Jack the Whipper, Adam Crack, Aaron Bonk, and I. And it's a show I've been producing now for about a year. We did our first one last year in Los Angeles and then our second one in New Jersey, New York, at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in the fall. And it's a four-person variety show all about whips. And we get to really, we're all such different characters. It's kind of Avengers style. Like, you bring all the characters together and they play together. And some of it's scripted and some of it's not. And it's really fun chaos.
Now, that seems, I wonder if that would work with jugglers. I don't know if that would work with like four juggling acts.
Because
I've never
could.
Seen it.
I think what it needs is, it's kind of Karamazov Brother-esque in that way, where you're watching these personalities all come together. But I think the thing that makes the Whippy Show really strong is how different we are. And then the structure of the show allows us to like, okay, Leah does a solo bit, Jack does a solo bit, and then Adam and Aaron do a thing together, and then Adam does a solo bit. And so it establishes our individual strengths. And then in the second act, it gets really chaotic and we like do contests and whip things out of each other's mouths and you get to kind of watch it all collide. But I think the strength is that we are all very, very strong individual characters individually. You know what I mean?
In addition to the whips, one of your big finales, I think it is your finale, is the trick where you do like a handstand or some kind of contortion move.
Mm-hmm.
And then you shoot a bow and arrow with your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And hit a target. What's sort of like the evolution of that trick? It seems to be one that's sort of been around for a while. Do you know kind of the history of it? And how hard is it to perform?
I believe it began in Mongolia. Contortion in Mongolia is similar to ballet in France. It's kind of a national art form of beauty. And I believe it originated in Mongolia. There's like images carved on clay pots of Mongolian contortionists shooting bows and arrows with their feet and things like that. I know of about five girls in the English-speaking world and in our country that do it, maybe six now or seven. And it was a trick I always really wanted to learn. And then during the pandemic, I finally had the time. So I put in a whole bunch of effort and days and days and years of that. It took about 2 years to kind of get down. And yeah, it's been great. I really love doing it. It's a huge finale. People love it. I miss sometimes, and that's always really exciting. I'll like hit the edge of the target, but not pop the balloon, and I'll have to do it again, and everybody loses their bananas. It's really fun. Yeah, it's good. It's not easy.
I don't think I've ever seen a male performer do that trick. Is that Is there a reason for that, you think, or just it just hasn't happened?
There aren't a ton of male contortionists in general. There's a few that I know. Kyle Craigle is an incredible one out of Las Vegas, a very good friend of mine. But yeah, you know, I really haven't seen that done either. I don't think there's a specific gender-based reason. I think it's a hard trick, and it takes a lot of time to learn. So if you got, it's, you know, it's kind of like juggling, where if you put the effort in, you deserve it, you know?
And to do contortion, do you feel like you need to be sort of naturally flexible, or is that something you developed during the course of your training?
For me, it's developed. It's trained. I am not, I do not have EDS or any of those other conditions that allow you to be hypermobile. I am trained and coached. And if I don't train, I lose it, or I feel like I get significantly worse quickly. So it's taken a lot of time for me to really kind of strengthen that all the way through, but we're working on it. I'm getting better all the time. So
let's talk a little bit more about your training, because like we said in the beginning, you're one of the performers who's had extensive training, where a lot of my other guests are more self-taught. Let's talk about some of the coaches you've had, some of the teachers. Like, you studied at the Celebration Barn with Avner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are some of the things that Avner the Eccentric passes along to you?
Yeah, I did a 2-week-long intensive at the Celebration Barn in 2007 or 8, a long time ago. No, maybe 2000. Yeah, I think around 2009. Yeah, super long time ago, and it was incredible, and I learned so much. Avner taught me to breathe. If anybody has taught and trained with him, you've probably heard that before. So much about breathing, just exhaling as soon as you step on the stage, and everybody will start breathing with you. Pacing and time, slow. Comedy is slow. Contrast, status, a lot of pacing work, for sure. My time at the barn was very, very powerful.
I think it's important to watch someone like Avner, because you can see someone occupying the space on stage, and they're not having to, like, all of a sudden be tap dancing and juggling, and, like, every moment has to be filled with this, like, frenetic action. Like, you can just exist on stage and be compelling.
Yep. Yes.
So he's a really great example of someone like that, who allows it sort of, like, to breathe. I think breathing is such a great metaphor for what he does, because his show does have a lot of a certain breath to it, a certain relaxed quality of, like, hey, I'm here, you know, I'm entertaining just being who I am without having to do much.
Yeah, and you can create the pacing of the space. You're in control. The audience isn't in control. You're in control. And if you can walk onto stage and define your space by how slow you move or how confident you stand, then you can play with it. Then you can get frenetic and crazy, and people will go with you because you're going hard, you know, like you have to take them on. You have to slow the car down long enough for them to get in with you. And then you can drive off and speed and go wherever you want. But if they don't have enough time to get in that car with you, you're going to take off without them.
Well, it's also important to know that if you come out like full energy and just super hyper, there's really nowhere to go. Are you going to get more hyper? Are you going to get more energetic?
Exactly.
It's good to have highs and lows and to sort of create a base level of sort of a place you can go different directions in.
Mm-hmm.
I think the car metaphor is a very good one. You can't start at 120 miles an hour.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's good to come out with a big, flashy start. But if you can't maintain that the whole show, unless you're like one of these 8-minute type of acts.
Right. And you can start with a big, flashy start and still maintain slow power. You know, like what it can be both. But you need that flashy start to feel confident and not desperate and frenetic.
Well, I like that term, slow power. That's mm-hmm. a good one.
Yeah, there's a quote that I love that's something like, we do not have much time, therefore we must move very slowly.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I really
it's
like
so
that.
Interesting when you watch jugglers too, the different styles. Like one of the most famous comedy jugglers, Michael Davis.
Yeah.
As sort of a thoughtful, laconic, sort of slow approach, where other ones like a Frankie Olivier is full on, you know, kind of manic.
Yeah.
And it's important to sort of find your particular rhythm. Another famous teacher you had, who unfortunately recently passed away, was at the Circus Center in San Francisco, Lu Yi.
Yeah.
Was he mm-hmm. a memorable teacher for you?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get to work with him too much. We worked together for about a year. And he was an acrobatic coach, and he trained my handstands. He was great.
And who are some of your female role models as teachers or as performers you looked up to?
That's a good call. Karen Montanaro was huge for me back in my Celebration Barn days. She was really helpful and patient and slow as well. Amanda Crockett is another incredible circus performer and clown that I worked with for a long time, and I really look up to her work is fantastic, and she taught me how to see, how to look and see with my eyes on stage, and see my props and see my space and see my reality. And our time together was really, really wonderful. Yeah, and then like even Paolo's wife, Ansa O'Leary, has been such a great mentor and friend of mine for a long time. She's so in control and organized and has a really wonderful mixture of chaos and matriarchy inside of her. And I really love working with her and being around her.
And it seems to me that you're very, it's very important to you to empower other female performers. You have a project, I believe it's coming up in March. It's the Mystify Magic Festival. Is
Yes.
that primarily for female performers? What's the basis of Mystify Magic Festival?
Yeah, so Mystify Magic Festival is a 3-day long entertainment festival focusing on women and magic. It is for everyone. Anyone can come. We welcome men, we welcome women, we welcome anybody of any gender to come and enjoy this festival and convention. It is a magic convention primarily, but it's really intended to be enjoyed and loved by anyone in variety arts, including theater and special effects and acting as well. We're getting a lot of people interested in that. It's so much of my team are jugglers. Taylor Glenn will be there doing video. Afton Benson's my director of development, and I could not do this convention without Afton. Afton is, we love Afton. Everybody loves Afton. God bless Afton. Afton.
Well, she's a big part of the
Architect.
IGA as well, big
Yes.
part of steering the direction of the IGA.
Absolutely.
And are you the main teacher? Are there other teachers as well?
So I'm the director. I'm directing this festival. It's my baby. And I will not be lecturing or performing. That is, we have an entirely femme-forward lineup. So we have over 30 people that will be
Wow.
performing. Like, I know it's huge,
It's
performing,
huge.
lecturing, and yeah, I know. I'm running a team of 45 people. It's insane. It's absolutely insane, and it's a scale so beyond what I originally thought that this would be. Everyone is so excited. We have some massive names in magic that are part of this. It's going to be sponsored by the Magic Castle, the Academy of Magical Arts, Magic Castle Enterprises, the Chicago Magic Lounge, Lance Burton, and all these other large magicians are throwing money and time and energy at us to make this happen. And magic has historically been a very patriarchy-formed industry, and juggling is that way too. But I would say that magic is significantly worse and even far behind the work that juggling has been doing.
Well, I think there's always been that stereotypical female assistant role
Yeah,
in both juggling and magic.
definitely. And magicians are, it's interesting because magic is kind of a gatekeepy world too, and as it needs to be for secrets to be maintained. So as an art form, it is about secrets, and it is about keeping things from people, and it is about passing things down in a secretive mentorship, where juggling is a little bit more of like, if you can learn it, you can do it, and if you can do it, it's yours. The secret is hours put into it and maybe a tip or two for better technique, but for the most part, it's just, did you spend time alone in your room trying it for months or not? And magic can be that way as well, but oftentimes you need a mentor to kind of teach you some technique behind. And I'm hoping that this festival allows people to meet each other. That's my biggest goal with this, and this entire project, is that opportunities come from people. And if we can bring people together, we can make more opportunities.
And did you mention where it was taking place?
Las Vegas. It is
Las
at the
Vegas.
Santa Fe Station Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, March 10th through 12th. And we also have tickets available for just the shows. So if you want to come and be involved, if you're a Las Vegas local or you're interested in coming to see this, but you don't want to attend an entire convention, you can get a ticket for a little less than half price and just come to our big gala shows.
And where can people find more information about it? Online somewhere?
MystifyMagicFestival.com.
MystifyMagicalFestival.com.
Yeah.
That's good. And now you have a lot of side projects, which is good. You produce shows, you're producing this festival. One interesting side project you have is as the producer director of the ABCs of Fitness. Now, I understand that fitness, of course, is a very big role for any performer. What's your relationship with fitness, and what do you teach in the ABCs of fitness?
Yeah, so I taught fitness for a bit. I did yoga teaching and other types of class-based coaching, and then flexibility and circus-based coaching as well. So I had a foundation in teaching, but I really wanted to take that to a broader scope. So I created a downloadable fitness program that's a series of 10-minute episodes, and they're rearrangeable. So you can do like a few of them in a row to get a 30-minute workout, or you can do just one to get a 10-minute workout, or you can do six of them to get an hour. And it allows you to really tailor your workout to what you need. So this program allowed like Cirque du Soleil artists to condition, or single moms from New Jersey to condition and to have the same based program. And I was able to use that and market it through the pandemic and afterwards to form a really cool community of people. And it's a funny program. There's a lot of humor and like goofiness in it. It's not very like white girl wellness, typical fitness program. It's a lot more welcome. I really appreciate kind of how that's gone. So yeah, it's been really fun to kind of to watch that move through in different phases.
Do you think it's important to have a sort of side projects? A lot of performers put all their eggs in one basket.
I really love it.
Do you feel like that helps you both financially and also just sort of creatively?
Yeah, personally, I love it. It brings me a lot of joy in what I do, and it allows me to have a lot of different, like to flex my muscles in different directions. I have some pretty strong ADD as well, you know, and I really like being able to kind of code switch from one project to the other, one role to another. And especially when I'm performing a lot and I'm being star or Leah, like stage Leah, it's nice to kind of pull that back and just be able to work from my computer for a bit and to not have to make that a necessary part of what I do.
Well, certainly having versatility to be able to do both the branding, the marketing, the producing festivals, and have sort of a diversity also in your venues. One we haven't talked about too much as part of your career is as a cruise ship headliner. Like, what are the similarities between like the Renaissance fairs, you know, as far as your show, and what you're expected to do on cruise ships?
Yeah, so I've been working for cruise ships for a little while in different ways. I worked for Princess a lot recently, and we worked their piazza. I worked their piazza space, so I would do kind of shorter shows in shorter spurts across the time. And those are really fun and easy and different. Yeah, cruises are interesting. You know, you have a lot of time off. You're out at sea for a while, a few days at a time, maybe a week or two at a time. And you have to kind of learn how to create your own schedule and be very self-motivated. And it gave me a lot of time to work on my other projects as well when I wasn't performing.
I think the Piazza program is a good sort of entry into cruises as well, because it's a little bit different and it's almost sort of a modified street show.
Yeah.
You're performing more in the, like a main plaza.
Right. I'm not sure if it's actually continuing, to be honest. I have heard whispers of it going away, and I have zero dates for my next 2 years. So I'm not sure. We are at the whim of corporate America. But yeah, it is definitely an interesting way to kind of get into it.
Well, cruise ships have been a very steady venue for jugglers. It does seem that they're making some pretty drastic changes.
Yeah.
Like some ships no longer allow you to have volunteers on stage.
Yeah.
Which is, if you're doing that length of time.
Right.
Sometimes they want 2 45-minute shows and they say, no volunteers.
Yeah, I don't.
It really cuts down the number of people who can do that kind of work.
Yes.
How big a part is volunteers in your shows? Are you a big one for using volunteers on stage?
I have 2 volunteer bits, and I don't need to do them, but I do like to do them. I have a bit. My show is very modular, so I can switch it around based on whoever is, what venue I'm in, or how much ceiling height I have, or if I'm outdoors or not, or if my body hurts or not. I have a bit with a kid, preferably a girl between like 12 and 15. And then I have a bit with usually like a larger dude as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess everybody's kind of larger than you, right? I mean, you go by tiny girl. Is it impolite to ask exactly how tiny are you?
I'm 5 feet tall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm 5 feet tall, about 100 pounds. So I'm small. And when I was coming up with the branding, it was important for me to have something that was not going to change. You know, I might dye my hair, but I'm not going to get any taller.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Now, when people want to find out more about you, they can go, of course, to tinygirlbigshow.com.
Yes.
And you have some merchandise for sale. Do you want to kind of promote a little bit of your merchandise?
I do, sure. Yeah, if you're a fan of the show, we have some stickers and some hoodies and some fun things. We printed a bunch of onesies too, which are really cozy, and super delightful. They have pockets and a hood. And yeah, it's fun. It's fun to kind of have some little giveaways and things that we can have fans support the work.
So once again, her website is tinygirlbigshow.com.
Yeah.
And of course, they also can support you in kind of a health issue you have, a health journey you're facing.
Yeah.
You can become a glucose guardian. Can you
Yeah.
explain what that is and how people can help support you in that way?
Absolutely. So I have type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease that attacks my pancreas. And essentially, what that means is I have to be my own pancreas and give myself insulin, which is the hormone that your pancreas produces if you are a working pancreas human. Lucky you. And insulin in our healthcare American system is insanely expensive. And it's not fun to be a self-employed entertainer without corporate healthcare working through that system. So I allowed a way for my fans and supporters to throw me a little extra cash to help me afford my medication that I need.
So once again, you can become a glucose guardian by going to tinygirlbigshow.com and support Leah in that way. Because like you said, that's another thing about being self-employed is we have to have our own insurance. And unfortunately, that's another big thing that's happening nowadays is the cost of medical insurance, the cost of any kind of medicine. It becomes very difficult to live
Yeah, indeed.
sometimes, especially as a self-employed performer.
Yes, very much so. But we're doing what we can.
Well, yeah, we do what we can. We're coming to the end of our time. Can you sort of give us some encouraging words or some words of wisdom for other performers?
One thing that I keep in mind is that the audience didn't come to see you, they came to see themselves. And being able to reflect back the human experience or what they might be experiencing back at them through art is what's going to really make your work impactful. So I'm a big fan of that quote.
Well, that's great. That's a really wonderful way to end the podcast. And also for me to appreciate you being on the podcast and sharing your wisdom and your experiences and your life with us on the Drop Everything podcast. Thank you so
Thank
much to
you.
my very special guest, Leah Orleans.
Thank you, Dan. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Leah. I hope you enjoyed Drop Everything podcast number 135, my conversation with Leah Orleans. Don't forget, you can check out the Mystify Magic Festival at mystifymagicfestival.com. That takes place at the Santa Fe Station Hotel in Las Vegas, March 10th through the 12th. Go to mystifymagicfestival.com for information now. Also, don't forget to go to the IJA, International Jugglers Association, at juggle.org. Find out about the festival this summer coming up in Indiana, and so much more at juggle.org. This is Dan Holzman from the Drop Everything organization. Just wanted to say, drop everything, except when you're juggling.